Every metropolitan area in the country has at least one agency or one office dedicated to economic development. The process goes on all the time, and it goes better in some places than in others, as is reinforced by an annual report called Best Performing Cities. Today's guest is one of the authors of that report, which ranks cities' economic development in big city and small city categories. San Francisco is the best performer among the large metro areas. Fargo, North Dakota, is the best among the smaller ones, and that smaller list includes Medford at number 91. Manoli Ratnatunga will visit Medford next week for the Southern Oregon Business Conference. She joins us today to talk about the best performing cities. Manoli, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you're an economist at the Milken Institute. Let's back up a step and ask what the Milken Institute is.
Sure. The Milken Institute is a nonpartisan, nonprofit economic think tank, and one of the focuses we have here in our work is on job creation and human capital, which is where the best performing cities work comes in.
And I see you previously worked on regional economic development yourself for the organization serving the greater Pittsburgh area.
That's correct.
So got some work on both ends of the equation here. The report itself, what do you take into account when figuring performance of metro areas in economic development?
Well, we look at a range of outcomes. So we look at job growth both in 5 years and the most recent 1 year. We look at wage growth to capture the quality of jobs, and then we look at high-tech growth, diversity, and concentration in an economy.
I noticed that there are weightings that you show. I mean, your methodology is very transparent in the report, and the weightings for the high-tech stuff is a little less than it is for the other categories you mentioned. What's the thinking there?
Well, the idea is that we want to look at overall economic health, and so jobs and wages across the entire economy are telling us how people are doing across the board. The high-tech aspect is an important way to capture the knowledge-based sector of your economy, but we don't want to weight it more than some of the other jobs.
So given the fact that 2014 seemed to be a pretty decent year economically in a number of ways, we were just talking in our first hour with folks about employment numbers in the state of Oregon, where the unemployment rate has finally gotten below 7%. It would seem that 2014 was a more active year than 2013. I know you had reports for both years. Was there a big difference between 2014 and 2013?
Well, our rankings are relative. So we certainly saw growth in a large number of metros. And you're beginning to see metros that did well through the recession fall behind as metros that lost lots of jobs during because of the housing bust, or because of the financial crisis, regaining a lot of jobs, and there's a lot of movement upwards for those metros.
So, for example, were the numbers just much bigger for San Francisco this year as number one than they were for Austin in 2013 as number one?
Yeah, and San Francisco has really had phenomenal wage growth in the last 1 and 5 years, and that drove a lot of its position on the rankings.
All right. That's I wanted to get into that a little bit then, because, I mean, the numbers are good. Much is said about the quality of jobs, though, with higher pay. And so are we seeing better paying jobs generally coming about as a result of the economic recovery continuing?
Definitely. We're seeing wage growth across the board.
Among the big cities, what are the kinds of things then, for example, that would have resulted in San Francisco bumping Austin out of the top spot?
Well, wage growth really was the largest part of San Francisco's ascent to number one. It's the first time that San Francisco has been at the top in the 15 years that we've done this report, while Austin has been a consistently good performer. And the two were reasonably close, but the wage growth really pushed San Francisco over the top. They had 45% of the growth in jobs in the last 5 years have come from high-skilled sectors, professional, scientific, and technical services. And that's unusual for the economy as a whole.
I wonder, though, in an area like San Francisco where the real estate is so expensive, if the wages are going to just naturally have to be higher, if there's sort of like a San Francisco surcharge, in effect, on wages to that you have to pay people that much more to get them to come there.
Well, there's certainly a concern over housing costs. And when we launched our report earlier this year or earlier this month, Mayor Lee in San Francisco was talking very eloquently about the need to build additional housing that is affordable so that the economic benefits accrue to everyone in the community, not just to the people working for tech and research firms.
I did find myself wondering, as I looked at the weightings we just talked about for relative high-tech GDP growth, and it's for 1 year and 5 year, and high-tech GDP location quotient, a number of high-tech industries, et cetera. These are not weighted as heavily as the non-high-tech categories in figuring out these rankings. If, for example, that you did give these equal weighting, given the preponderance of high technology in the San Francisco metro area, would San Francisco be blowing away the field by a lot more than it is now?
Well, certainly if we increased the weighting on high-tech, they would have done better this year. But keep in mind that the high-tech jobs are counted twice in a way. They're counted in the overall economy, and then we give them an extra weight for those high-tech sectors.
I see there's a whole lot of Texas, a number of Texas cities in the top 20. Is that fairly typical?
Texas metros have done very well in the last 5 years because of the energy boom. And our data, because we use national sources, there's a lag in when it becomes available. And so we still have very high energy prices in the data that we were looking at. And that means that they have jobs that are being created in energy extraction and processing, in petrochemical manufacturing, but also because their state government didn't have to make the kinds of cuts that other state governments had to make when they saw revenues decline, they were able to continue to grow their university systems and so on. So you've seen growth across the board there.
Much more to talk about with Manoli Ratnatunga. She is one of the authors. There are three authors of Best Performing Cities. We're talking about Best Performing Cities 2014, ranking of cities in economic development in large and small categories. We'll talk a little more specifically about the cities in our region as we go through this. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as well. Back on the program with Manoli Ratnatunga and you in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the economist Manoli Ratnatunga from the Milken Institute. She is one of three authors of the report Best Performing Cities 2014, 15 years worth of reports that rank cities across the country in large and small city categories based on economic development. San Francisco's number one among the big cities. Fargo, North Dakota, number one among the small cities. We'll talk about where our cities show up, obviously mostly in the small category. As we go through the program, Manoli Ratnatunga will be in Medford next week for the Southern Oregon Business Conference, but we've got a chance to grab her ear now. You can join us on the exchange with comments, questions, thoughts about economic development and its process in cities large and small. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about you using national sources for the report. Is that partly just to make sure that there's a consistency of data that you get from city to city to city?
Absolutely.
All right. Now, and I have noticed before that, for example, you go looking for the most recent federal numbers, and they tend to be not from last year, but often from the year before. So when you talk about that lag, I mean, if we're talking about a 2014 report, are some of these figures from before 2013 even?
Well, if you look at the job numbers are reasonably current, so those run to the end of 2013. We did the analysis towards the end of 2014, so 2014 numbers weren't available. Unfortunately, the wage growth numbers lag even further, so those end in 2012.
All right, so there will be a little bit of a lag here in figuring things out. So in some cases, you're actually combining data sets from different years to come up with an overall ranking.
That's correct.
All right. Now, I noticed that we just talked about how Texas has a lot of cities in the top 20. Is part of the factor here, I mean, Texas and the former governor of Texas now, Rick Perry, talked a lot about how much he had to offer versus higher tax states like California, like Oregon even, although I don't know if he ever mentioned Oregon specifically. In your analysis, did that enter into what was going on with so many cities in Texas showing such robust economic growth?
It may have contributed. We don't look at the inputs. We just look at the outcomes. So we're not evaluating tax structures or quality of life factors when we construct our rankings. We just look at what did that all turn into in terms of jobs and quality jobs. But Texas saw a lot of population growth during the course of the recession when people move there, and that means that you have job creation in supporting industries as well, so education, healthcare, those kinds of things, in addition to the energy growth. And the governor was very aggressive in trying to recruit companies to come locate in Texas based on their business climate. But looking at San Francisco and San Jose, for example, doing so well on our rankings based on the density of talent that they're able to attract and the innovation that occurs that comes out of those clustering of talented people means that it's not just about tax rates.
Now, I know you get the rankings just based on sets of numbers, but it looks like there's further analysis, certainly of the top 20, that goes beyond just the raw numbers that lead to the rankings. I mean, do you do a certain amount of survey work, just checking to see what some of the other factors are that make these places what they are?
Well, we look at the numbers to come up with the rankings, and then we try and understand for the top 25 large cities and for the 10... small cities that were ranked at the top, what was it that contributed to their performance, to try and understand, you know, what companies were opening offices there, what industries have been growing, but also what significant policy changes have there been, if any, that might have contributed to the growth.
And when you get into that analysis of each of the places, do you see things like quality of life as coming up as an influence, at least in the things that people tell you?
Certainly. For certain places, the desire of people to live there and the quality of place seems to be very important. Being able to attract and retain high-skill workers, and it's not enough. You know, you still need to have a job for the person once they're there, but it seems to contribute to some of the places being able to sustain growth over time.
Manoli, how sensitive are the rankings to maybe not singular events, but maybe a series of events like big hires by one employer or something along those lines?
Well, that's part of the reason that we separate out our rankings into 200 large metros and 179 small metros. The small metros range from cities like Medford, which are, you know, above the metro area is above 200,000 people, down to about 50,000 people, and comparing places with 50,000 people to Los Angeles or New York would be unfair, because small changes like what might be a major employment increase, like 500 people being hired at a new factory, will have a much larger impact on a small city than on a large city.
And so what is the cutoff between the big guys and the little guys?
So we just rank it based on population by the census in the metro area. I think this year it was around 260,000 people. More than that made you a large city.
Okay. So as we look at the small cities, I'm guessing that anything under 200,000 would or under 260, as you said, it's a pretty broad category. You said 179, was it, somewhere
yes,
in that neighborhood?
That's
okay.
Right.
So mighty big category for sure. Columbia, Missouri, I noticed, where the University of Missouri, my alma mater, is located, number one last year, fell 10 places. Is that an unusual amount of movement?
Not at all. Like I said, with the small metros, there's smaller changes can have a big impact on your ranking, and so a 10-place movement isn't a huge deal, especially because our rankings are based on growth in a lot of the categories. And so once you've grown, you may not do that every year, and so that can affect your ranking.
And I noticed that Fargo, North Dakota, and, of course, the metro area spills over into the Minnesota side as well, number one this year. So what are some of the factors that put Fargo atop the list?
Well, it's bolstered by the oil and gas drilling that's happening. That was happening during the period that we evaluated. And then there are knock-on effects in terms of demand for support services, but also healthcare and education and so on in the metro area, drawing from the increased activity in the broader Fargo area.
You know, I'm curious. You mentioned you've been doing this report for 15 years. I'm not sure how long you've been involved with it directly, but Fargo, for example, was Fargo way down the list before the development of the Bakken oil shale formation?
I think it certainly moved up a lot in recent years.
All right. So Medford, where you'll be next week, I see jumped from 114 on the 2013 list to 91 on the 2014 list. That's a pretty good jump, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's based on improved performance on the 1 and 5 year job growth measures that we looked at. I think on the 5 year measure, you moved from 81st to 34th out of the 179 small metros that we rank. Actually, no, that was on the 1 year. I apologize.
And have you done some further analysis of some of the dynamics going on in Medford, given that you'll be in town next week?
Absolutely, yes. And the interesting story seems to be how well Medford performed on some of our high-tech measures. You know, it ranked 11th out of 179 metros for the diversity of its high-tech sector and 17th out of 179 on how important the high-tech sector is to the local economy. On our previous report in 2013, Medford actually ranked first among small cities for the diversity of its high-tech sector.
And for the folks who might not know, I mean, what are some of the high-tech businesses that that get cited in this analysis?
Well, you seem to have a lot of high-tech manufacturing subsectors that are doing well, creating things like control and monitoring equipment, and that's an important and growing part of your economy.
We're talking to Manoli Ratnatunga with the Milken Institute. She's an economist there and is one of the authors of the Best Performing Cities series of reports, Best Performing Cities 2014, out. And we are talking about it now prior to Manoli's appearance in Medford next week at the Southern Oregon Business Conference. It ranks cities, big and small, in separate categories for their economic development gains or losses in the past year. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the subject matter. Your questions and comments welcome. 800-838-3760 around the listening area. 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So Medford again at number 91 on this list of small cities. Eugene is down there at number 147. But it did make the list of big gainers. It jumped up from 195. So that's pretty impressive. But again, it sounds like in a smaller area with less population, a few key events can really drive the numbers up.
That's true. And but, you know, Eugene is ranked on our large cities list. So it's got competition from some of the larger cities as well.
Large cities. Okay, my mistake there. All right. So it's not it's lumped in there with Medford and the other small cities.
No.
Okay, just because of the size, again, of the metro area.
Correct.
I think I'm working on the small cities list again when I talk about Corvallis, because I noticed that that this is a significant drop in the case of it. Corvallis, Oregon, dropped from 36 from last year's list to 105 this year. And I have to believe that, again, a single change can be magnified by the lack of population in a metropolitan statistical area.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the advantages that Medford has is that the tech sector is relatively diverse for a city of your size. If you have one large employer, you're more vulnerable to corporate restructuring or things that affect that particular company.
Let's go back in time then and talk about the beginning of the series of reports, the best performing cities. You mentioned it's been going on for 15 years now. Describe to us, if you would, the process of deciding to make this and the work that goes into it, because it must be significant.
Well, we started the series as a section in the Forbes magazine. They were interested in having our chief research officer, Ross Duvall, come up with a methodology that would evaluate cities based on their actual performance, to try and help cities compare themselves to their peers on things that aren't subjective. You know, quality of life might mean something different to different people, people who choose to live in Manhattan versus people who choose to live in Boulder, Colorado. And so we wanted to look specifically at outcomes and to include some measure of the knowledge-based economy. So that was the genesis of it, and after a couple of years of running in Forbes on an annual basis, we spun it out and made it a self-standing report that the Milken Institute publishes every year.
Is there a certain amount of pride trumpeting that goes with this? I mean, does San Francisco get a sticker to put on all of its city stuff or something for being number one this year?
We certainly noticed that metro areas, the economic development organizations, often trumpet their performance on our report. And it's something that people look at. I moved from Pittsburgh to California to work for the Milken Institute, and my colleagues in Pittsburgh were annoyed that they dropped in the rankings and sent me emails to that effect. But yeah, it's a good way of benchmarking how you're doing against your peers. You might see growth in your economy, but it's hard to tell whether you're growing as much as you should be based on how the national economy is performing. And so this is a way of checking in on other cities and seeing how the policies that you're implementing locally are performing compared to ones that might be done in other cities.
So I wonder if you get some reactions of people feeling like they are, you know, perpetual bridesmaids instead of brides. Columbus, Indiana, for example, is number two in the small cities for the second year in a row. So it managed to not move up to number one, but not drop below number two either. Does this produce some reflection on the parts of people involved in economic development in those regions thinking, yeah, you know, we should have done more, or, you know, what's wrong with us or anything like that?
I think because these are very macro outcomes, and you have to look at how other places are doing. You know, Columbus doesn't have huge amounts of shale activity going on. It's hard to compete with some of these cities that have, you know, one industry that suddenly rockets up the charts in terms of employment. And so I think people are aware of how their what their industry's strengths are, what their general health is. But it's useful to see how you're doing compared to others.
Are there any cautionary notes that come out with the report, like, you know, not to take it too seriously, you know, don't take it too hard if you dropped substantially this year, if you still like where you live and that sort of thing?
I mean, I'm not going to suggest that anyone moves based on the rankings on this report. Obviously, you have a sense of how your company is doing, how your employer is doing, and what the opportunities are for you. This is more how can policymakers evaluate what they're doing, and are they, when they look at a city that they consider a peer, if they're falling behind, what is it that's being done differently in their peer city?
Now, I notice when you get into the analysis, as you go city by city through the top 20s, that there are assets and liabilities given. And in some cases, the liabilities can be cautionary notes that might give a clue to things that could happen that would be negative in years to come. For example, Auburn, Opelika, Alabama, number 10 on a small cities list. One of the liabilities listed, or the liability listed, is budget constraints will continue to cut into the universities. This is Auburn University's staffing and enrollment. So things that you would not think would be directly a part of economic development end up having impacts anyway. And something like a university can make a big difference, it would appear.
Absolutely. I mean, there are a number of university cities that do well on our index, depending on how healthy the university is. Often the university is a major employer. Universities that see large increases in the number of students that attend, and there are some that have made a conscious effort to increase, some state universities that have made a conscious effort to increase enrollment. And then you see students spending their money in the local community and the knock-on effects of that. So if the university faces serious budget cuts and may reduce the enrollment, then you might see less money being spent in restaurants and bars and in retail stores and so on, and that can have an impact on the community as a whole.
Are you aware of any communities that have revised or made some changes to what they're doing in economic development based on what they've seen in the best performing cities reports of the past?
Well, we've certainly had mayors tell us that this is part of the platform that they're running on, that they're going to try and get themselves out of the bottom tier and that sort of thing. I think it can be. We've certainly had conversations with metropolitan areas that have found this to be a way to mobilize the community. Civic engagement is very important to the success of a city, and if things are falling behind, sometimes it can be a way of showing people that it's not just that, you know, we're losing industry and that's just terrible, but that other cities that you might think would be losing industry are actually managing to succeed, and so we should too, and what can we do to try and get there?
I'm curious about the way some of these metropolitan statistical areas are drawn. You just take what the feds give you in terms of what they identify as an MSA, right?
That's right. So the Bureau of Economic Analysis look and the Census, they look at commuting patterns and economic connections between adjacent areas and define these metropolitan statistical areas, which is what we generally use to define what the cities are. And that's meant to capture, you know, sometimes the political boundaries don't actually mark the economic boundaries, and this is an attempt to capture the economic boundaries.
Yeah, well, yeah, the reason the question comes up is as you look at the list of small cities in particular, I mean, most of these make sense. St. Cloud, Minnesota, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, Blacksburg, Christiansburg, Radford, Virginia. But then you get to Napa, California, and think, well, wait a minute, if they're including San Mateo, San Jose with San Francisco, why does Napa get its own area? But it's, you know, that's based on, and then right below that is Barnstableton, Massachusetts, out on Cape Cod, which I never thought of as a metro area in any way, shape, or form.
Well, there's economic activity that's happening in Napa, for example, and it's distinct economically from the San Francisco area. And so I think that's part of why they choose to separate those two out.
All right. So it's just, again, what the divisions are in metropolitan statistical areas. Were there any big surprises in the reports for you as you look at where the numbers placed the rankings?
Well, having moved recently from the Midwest, I was surprised to see quite a few Midwestern cities ranking in the coming up in our category of cities that declined the most. And when I dug into the data, it really was that a lot of them hadn't seen the kind of construction boom and bust, and so they didn't lose the jobs to regain them. But there were, I think, like 5 Pennsylvania metropolitan areas on that list, which was disappointing to me, but made sense once I looked into the data.
All right, much more to talk about with Manoli Ratnatunga, one of the authors of Best Performing Cities 2014, also Best Performing Cities 2013. She's an economist with the Milken Institute. We'll be in Medford next week for the Southern Oregon Business Conference, and we'll come back and talk more with her, and you can join us as well by phone or email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We are talking today about economic development and rankings of cities around the country and how they're doing in economic development. Our rankings come from the Best Performing Cities Report. Best Performing Cities 2014 is put out by the Milken Institute. Manoli Ratnatunga is one of the 3 authors of it and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's an economist at the Milken Institute focused on regional economic development and regional competitiveness. She actually once did regional economic development in the Pittsburgh area before moving to the Milken Institute. She'll be in Medford next week for the Southern Oregon Business Conference put on by SoReady, Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development, Inc. That is Thursday at the Inn at the Commons in Medford. You can join the discussion right now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. That last point you brought up before the break is really interesting, the concept of how things that didn't happen can affect your ranking in these lists. And we were talking about the biggest declining cities, and the top 3 are true Rust Belt cities: Peoria, Illinois; Erie, Pennsylvania; and York, Hanover, Pennsylvania. And you mentioned construction. So if you actually didn't have a big fall off in economic activity, in other words, it's more of a steady state in your city, and therefore you're not getting a huge boom to follow a bust, it might actually end up having you ranked lower?
Right. So you would have ranked higher during the recession, and maybe you ranked higher than you might have because you were stable, and then now you're sort of declining more than you should because you're being overtaken by cities that lost lots of jobs and now are regaining them.
Now, I noticed that, and we mentioned earlier the fact that change at one employer can make a big difference, and that appears to be the case in Peoria, which fell 102 spots to its 2014 rank from its 2013 rank, and that happened a lot because of what happened at Caterpillar.
That's right.
And Caterpillar slowed down international sales because of heavy construction and mining equipment not that much in demand. So big differences that come to small towns. Having had the experience you've had in economic development over the years, I mean, is there a standard playbook for how everybody approaches economic development, or can it differ as much as the people from region to region?
I think there's definitely a variety of approaches that are successful. I mean, some places have regional assets that they can really build on, you know, research universities, core companies that are innovative and spin out a lot of companies and startups. Other places have natural resources that they can build on, or energy resources that we've seen with the shale development all over the country. And so there are lots of different strategies that work for different places. One of the things that we think all cities could benefit from is how they can best create pathways for students from high school and higher education into employment, because we hear from employers around the country how difficult they find it to attract and retain qualified staff.
I'm trying to figure out where that comes from. So they're saying they need a pathway to get students from college directly to them?
Well, it's more that they say they're having trouble hiring qualified staff for positions that they would like to fill. And partly that's that they're not offering wages that are high enough. Maybe they're located in a city that people don't want to move to because it's not considered a quality place. But often it's that there's a mismatch in the skills that people are developing in high school or at college or in community college and the skills that the employer is looking for. And so by creating these pathways, and cities that do this well are likely to be more attractive to potential employers. So they're going to be looking for places that can help them and make it as easy as possible for them to access a skilled workforce. And we think these public-private partnerships between education providers and the employers can really help smooth that transition.
In a sense, to get students aware of what the businesses do even before they're out of school.
Absolutely. We've seen some employers fund academies, for example, that encourage high school students to take community college classes while they're in high school that are relevant to a degree, relevant to a career in, let's say, agriculture, so that when they graduate from high school, they have the option and a qualification that would allow them to get a higher skilled job within the agriculture industry.
Let us take a call. We have Jim in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Manoli Ratnatunga. We're talking about economic development in the Best Performing Cities report.
Yes, I'm a little curious. In considering economic development, do you take into consideration how prepared they were for it? In other words, all of the public services that were obviously going to be needed. I would be very curious in Fargo to know what the high school graduation rate is and what's projected, youth crime rate, that sort of thing. And there's one other city. How is Denver rated? That's the most unspoken city in the United States. It draws people from all cultures, from all compasses, you know, all points of the compass. It's one of the more stable cities. To me, it is, anyway.
All right. Thanks for that, Jim.
Thank you.
Well, we as I said earlier, we don't consider the policies that contribute to economic growth. We just look at how successful they were in creating economic growth. So things like putting public services in place obviously becomes a challenge for some small cities that see dramatic growth over a short period of time. Hopefully they have the resources quickly in order to put those services in place. And it can contribute to growth, right? And we've seen that in Texas, that education services have grown significantly as they've grown as a city. With regards to Denver, they do perform well, and they...
there's Denver, number
12.
Okay, yeah.
And up three places from last year. And they see a pretty solid growth on jobs, 3% faster than the national economy. A lot of their growth seems to depend on how high-tech funding is going, you know, venture funding and so on. But they've invested seriously in their services and are trying to become invest in being an attractive place to live.
I made a mistake when I was talking about Napa and the confines of the Metropolitan Statistical Area. San Jose, Sunnyvale, Santa Clara is its own MSA and shows up number 4 behind San Francisco, San Mateo, Redwood City at number 1. So don't think of San Francisco as having San Jose's high tech in with it. It's all off by itself as well.
Yeah, for our report, we actually split up for some of the very large metropolitan areas. We split them up into metropolitan divisions. So the San Jose metro area is separated out.
So together, they would be a gigantic juggernaut. And of course, they are. I mean, they got commuter lines running between the cities, et cetera.
Absolutely. And there's, as a place to attract talent, and especially when you have two career families, that's an attractive asset to have.
You know, I haven't even thought to ask about some of the bigger cities in the country on the large cities list, and I'm scanning as we speak for New York City or L.A. Did you chop those up into smaller areas as well? Now I see Los Angeles, Long Beach down at number 42.
Yeah, they are split into smaller, these metropolitan divisions, but they still don't make it up. It's harder to be dynamic as a large city, but you do see cities like San Francisco and San Jose succeeding. So it's certainly possible.
And where does New York end up on this list, and how tightly did you draw the lines around it?
I think that New York, we split New York and New Jersey, some of the New Jersey metros apart, even though they would be considered one large metro area. I think they're down somewhere in the middle of the pack. Let me just have a look. New York, White Plains, Wayne, New Jersey, New York, New Jersey, Maryland. So it's a large area, even though we do split it up, ranked number 62 this year.
All right. So, you know, not great. But as you mentioned, the larger areas, it sounds like they have a bit more inertia there. It's just they've got so many numbers tied up in them and probably move somewhat slowly.
Right. I mean, to grow by 1% takes a lot more jobs in New York than it would in Medford, for example.
So to come back, we were talking a bit about the role of education in trying to make connections to employers. And I wonder if there's anything that you do at the Milken Institute outside of the compiling of data that points to ways in which education can become more flexible. It seems like as conditions within industry change, the expectations that are out there for workers seem to change a bit faster than they used to. And I think I've heard the call certainly for people to say, hey, you know, education needs to keep up with what's going on out there.
Well, and I think lifelong learning initiatives are very important, looking at how community colleges can adapt to the needs of employers and the changing industries. I mean, higher skilled workers, so people who have a bachelor's degree or community college, are more likely to be able to adapt to changes in the economy. So we see that as being a crucial factor in how well a workforce can adapt to changes that come, either economic or financial, in the future.
I wonder how hard an area that has pretty good growth in a general run of years has to work toward economic development. I mean, if you're San Francisco and people flock to you anyway, I mean, do you really have to put that much money, public money, into economic development versus a place like Medford where people might not have heard of you, but you got some pretty good conditions and it's a fun place to live, that sort of thing?
I think that you maybe have to spend less money on marketing if you're San Francisco, but I think it's there are cost increases that come with being a large city. Rent is higher, wages are higher, and so to attract businesses to come locate there, you need to find ways in which to ease the process of setting up a business or finding a location, and that might take more work in a city like San Francisco than it would in Medford.
When the economy is down, as it was for several years there, I'm curious to know, in regional economic development agencies like the one you worked for in Pittsburgh, I mean, are efforts scaled back when the economy is down? Are they picked up when the economy is down?
I think it really depends on the place. I think that a lot of, you know, when you're competing for fewer company locations, that can slow. People can make different choices about whether they want to really invest to try and grab what there is, or they scale back because they don't have the budget for it. In Pittsburgh, we were fortunate that coincided with the growth in the energy industry in Pennsylvania with the Marcellus Shale development, and so we certainly did not scale back.
Which raises some questions about Pittsburgh itself, which still remains an interesting and vibrant place years after the steel industry ceased to be a major factor there. I mean, how did Pittsburgh make that transition, which for folks who don't live there looks like it happened pretty easily?
Well, I don't think it was easy. I think that when the steel industry left, or large portions of the steel industry left, we still have some very significant employment in the steel industry. But there was a sense that a lot of people migrated away. You'll find Steelers fans around the country. And what we had, though, in Pittsburgh was a very strong civic community, a very engaged private sector and foundations that could fund innovative projects. And so they, through the universities and through some of the nonprofits, you were able to diversify the economy. And now we have, you know, top-tier health providers, we have a very active tech industry, but that didn't come easy. I mean, it was a lot of work.
So given the amount of work that does go on in economic development generally, I mean, how intense is the competition between regions now to land employers, to I don't know if it's still the same sort of game that it used to be, where you're trying to get a major manufacturer to come into your town.
I think there's less of that, although some states and cities are still focusing on that as their strategy. I think there's a lot of interest in what the small business sector can contribute, looking at startups, looking at owner-operated companies, and how you foster the growth of the next rather than just trying to poach someone else's company from somewhere else.
And for that matter, has the landscape changed a bit, too, because of the fact that given computers and telecommuting and the ubiquity of the Internet, that people don't really have to be in one place to do a job they used to do in a fixed position?
Certainly there's more flexibility, but we see in our research that there's really still a benefit to co-location, so that you do see more innovation in places where a lot of people who are entrepreneurial are located in one place.
I can see this is a fascinating field to work in, and is this a lifelong thing for you, you think?
I think so, yes.
Manoli Ratnatunga has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's an economist at the Milken Institute and co-author of the Institute's annual Best Performing Cities Report. We've been talking about Best Performing Cities 2014. She will be at the Southern Oregon Business Conference put on by SoReady, Southern Oregon Economic Development, Inc. Tim Dewey from the University of Oregon will be there as well. This is all next Thursday, January 29th, at the Inn of the Commons in Medford. Manoli, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet.